From To the Best of Our Knowledge and Public Radio International, a special series, author, great writers on great books. This hour, Writing the World. Toni Morrison once said, "We die. That may be the meaning of life. But we do language. That may be the measure of our lives." This hour, conversations with some of the world's great novelists. We'll talk with Toni Morrison about the racism she experienced growing up.
I'm not going to spend a lot of energy on it. It was not the all-consuming thing for me. But what was consuming were the relationships among us and how history or the society formed us.
Also, a frank conversation with controversial writer V.S. Naipaul on Islamic fundamentalism.
The Islamic peoples should stay in their own lands, but they should, as it were, be subjected to a kind of quarantine. I think we are going to get there very soon.
And a very different take on Islam from Turkey's greatest writer, the 2006 Nobel Prize winner Orhan Pamuk. Also, Alice Walker on the role of the poet during the time of war.
This is the time for which we're born. This is the time when the poet is useful, because poetry is not a luxury. Poetry is as necessary as bread.
But first, we go to the movies. Sherman Alexie wrote and directed the film The Business of Fancy Dancing. It's about two Indian friends who leave the reservation for college in Seattle and what happens when one of them decides to go home.
I'm leaving school. Going back home, back to the res. Car's all packed up. Come with me. 5 hours, then we can celebrate. We'll get drunk like Indians, man.
No.
There's nothing for us here. We don't belong here.
I don't belong on the reservation.
You were always too good for the rest of us, huh?
I am better than the rest of them.
How can you say that, man? That's our tribe, man. That's our reservation.
And you're better than the rest of them. You just don't want to admit it.
Better than all these white people here.
A scene from Sherman Alexie's film The Business of Fancy Dancing. Alexie is a Spokane Indian with strong opinions about what it means to be a real Indian. That question also keeps popping up in his collection of short stories called 10 Little Indians. Steve Paulson asked Alexie to read an excerpt from one story, The Search Engine, about a young Indian woman who's gone off to college.
Corliss didn't want to live with a white roommate either, no matter how interesting he or she might become. Hell, even if Emily Dickinson were resurrected and had her reclusive hermit unrequited love addict gene removed from her DNA, Corliss wouldn't have wanted to room with her. White people, no matter how smart, were too romantic about Indians. White people looked at the Grand Canyon, Niagara Falls, the full moon, newborn babies, and Indians with the same goofy sentimentalism. Being a smart Indian, Corliss had always taken advantage of this romanticism, but that didn't mean she wanted to share the refrigerator with it. If white folks assumed she was serene and spiritual and wise simply because she was an Indian and thought she was special based on those mistaken assumptions, then Corliss saw no reason to contradict them. The world is a competitive place, and a poor Indian girl needs all the advantages she can get. So if George W. Bush, a man who possessed no remarkable distinctions other than being the son of a former U.S. president, could also become president, then Corliss figured she could certainly benefit from positive ethnic stereotypes and not feel any guilt about it. If she lived with a white person, Corliss knew she'd quickly be seen as ordinary, because she was ordinary. It's tough to share a bathroom with an Indian and continue to romanticize her. If word got around that Corliss was ordinary, even boring, she feared she'd lose her power and magic. She knew there would come a day when white folks finally understood that Indians are every bit as relentlessly boring, selfish, and smelly as they are. And that would be a wonderful day for human rights, but a terrible day for Corliss.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, you really have it out for white people, white liberals who like Indians. That keeps coming up in a lot of these stories.
Oh, I have it out for everybody. You know, I made fun of George W. in that paragraph. I made fun of liberals. I made fun of Indians. No, I have it out. Everybody's ridiculous. I'm misanthropic.
But in particular, it seems like some of the ideas that Indians are especially spiritual or that they're close to the earth.
Well,
I mean, all of those.
Yeah, the idea that we're special is ridiculous. You know, the whole New Age movement is based on as many stereotypes as genocide was. So it's just, you know, two sides of the same coin. I just think it's funny. You know, when these New Agers show up on the res looking for a highly traditional and sacred Indian man, and you wouldn't believe how many Indian men suddenly become highly sacred and traditional.
So there are plenty of Indians on the res who want to play that role.
Yeah, who, you know, become highly sacred and traditional in the presence of highly attractive German women. Indian guys with one tooth, you know, becoming shaman. They start flossing that thing. It shines. But we're all that way. I mean, we're all human beings. We're certainly going to take advantage of the opportunities presented us. And Indians get those opportunities. And, you know, what's so wrong with that? I mean, we've been, you know, abused and genocided and oppressed and lied to and distorted and destroyed for centuries. So if you know, some Indian man or woman gets laid now and again because they're Indian. So, you know, it's certainly, it's still not even. It's still like, you know, 8 million to 1.
Well, tell me a little bit about this woman who we just heard about in the passage you read, Corliss. She's gone off to college. She ends up finding this old book by some obscure Indian poet, a guy named Harlan Atwater. But tell me about that story.
Well, Corliss is an 18-year-old Spokane Indian who grew up in the city of Spokane, has gone to college, first person in her family to go to college. So she finds this book by this Spokane Indian poet she'd never heard of, and she loves poetry. You know, she often imagines herself as Gerard Manley Hopkins. She loves poetry so much. So she goes looking for him because she doesn't understand why she doesn't know who he is because the Spokane tribe is so small.
Well,
so
she ends up tracking the guy down, and he did not want to be tracked down.
He did not want to be found, and she finds out he was, you know, he was adopted out. He wasn't even raised as a Spokane Indian.
Well, and after he's told her his story, he asks, so what are the lessons here?
Yeah.
And they sort of trade back and forth some very funny lessons. One of his is, never pretend to be an Indian when you're not. And that's, I mean, that's sort of a question that keeps coming up.
That's all of us. That's me.
Who's a real Indian?
I try not to pretend to be an Indian. I don't have any idea. Well, but it's always the stereotypes. It's always, you know, it's always the rowdy warrior activist. So it still goes back to the old stereotypes. It's the Indian on the warpath, or it's the Indian hanging around the fort. Those are the two stereotypes. And those have manifested themselves in the rowdy political activist or the feel-good environmentalist. But it's still variations on the same stereotypes. And we're none of those things. You know, Indians spend their lives worrying. They're poor people. You know, I mean, Indians are white people with more melanin and longer hair. And so the concerns of Indians, by and large, are the same ones as poor people everywhere in this country. You know, paying rent, you know, having food, worrying about school. And so those are the kind of stories that need to be told. And I'm just sick and tired of Native literature's, you know, insistence on its spirituality. It's like we're all a bunch of Jesuit priests running around trying to write, you know, our version of the Bible. And it's fundamentalist and limiting and unrealistic. 70% of Indians live in urban areas now. You know, and most of those people are not what you would call spiritual. They're everyday, ordinary folks. And that's one of the reasons I wrote this book. It's white-collar Indians.
But what struck me is, I mean, this question keeps getting asked, who's a real Indian? Who's an authentic Indian? I mean, clearly that question bugs you.
But it's the question in the Indian world.
But it is the question, and it keeps coming back. And
we're a colonized people. And if you talk to any colonized people anywhere in the world, if you go talk to Maoris or, you know, the Aboriginals in Australia or African countries or India or Pakistan, you know, or even the Middle East, you know, you talk about the situation about Israel and Palestine, it's all about identity. Who's more authentic? Authentically indigenous to the Middle East. That's what that argument is all about. So the idea of asking who is an Indian is the same as asking who belongs, you know, on the Gaza Strip. It's a variation on the same thing. And it's about belonging. It's about feeling disconnected, feeling like you're roaming. And when you're an Indian, a person from here, you're indigenous to here, and you're an immigrant at the same time. We've been here for at least 10,000 years, and yet we're still outsiders to this country. And that's maddening and you know, bipolar causing. So you got all these Indians running around like manic, depressive, multiple personality Sybil Eves. Most of us handle it all right, you know, but it's still a constant conflict and worry for us.
You now live in Seattle.
Yes.
You've got a couple of kids yourself. You must think about this. I mean, how you're going to raise your children.
You know, it's interesting. I think about it less and less. I used to sort of buy into that idea that it's a struggle to be Indian in a white world. you know. But now I realize, no, I live equally well on both sides of my hyphen.
So you don't feel like you have to choose between the res and living in Seattle?
No, I get to choose between two cultures. Because no matter what degree of Indian I am, I'm still white because I grew up in a white culture in a white country. We're all white, no matter what else we are. And so I get to choose. And I don't want to have to choose, you know, pick between things. I want it all. You know, hunger is my crime. I don't want to choose between Jean-Claude Van Damme and Wilma Mankiller. I want them both. I don't want to choose between, you know, Carson McCullers and John Trudell. I want it both. I want powwows and NBA basketball games. And because I have the ability to move equally well in both, my life is squared, cubed, you know, a scientific notation with the possibilities I have. And I celebrate that.
But I would think that there might be some more specific questions like, how much do you want your kids to know about Spokane tradition, history, and all of that? Or is that just going to come naturally?
You know, it's funny, the parallel that popped into my head is, you know, I know Walt Whitman and William Blake because I know Allen Ginsberg. Even though I read Whitman and Blake, but I know them better because of Allen Ginsberg. So in some sense, you know, my kids know my grandparents and my great-grandparents because they know me. I don't need some book or some, you know, list of things my children are supposed to know about Spokane-ness to know that they're Spokane. And above all else, they're Joseph and David, you know. and that's who they're going to, you know, they're nice Jewish Catholic Native Americans.
Sherman Alexie wrote the screenplay for the film The Business of Fancy Dancing and is the author of numerous books, including the short story collection 10 Little Indians. Steve Paulson spoke with him. In 1982, Alice Walker published what has become a modern American classic, the novel The Color Purple. The book became a bestseller. It won the Pulitzer Prize, and it was subsequently made into a movie starring the young Oprah Winfrey. Though Walker's fame came as a novelist, she considers herself a poet. And after the terrorist attacks on 9/11, it was Alice Walker, the poet, who responded with a collection of poems entitled Absolute Trust in the Goodness of the Earth. Alice Walker remembers how she felt on September 11th.
I was feeling grief not just because of the tragedy itself and all the children, for instance, left without their parents, I think 5,000 of them without parents. But I was thinking how terrible it was for our government to think immediately of inflicting the same kind of suffering on other people when that wasn't my idea of what we were supposed to learn from it.
You wrote a number of different poems that approach it from different angles. I remember one in which you describe people leaping from the building holding hands, which was an image that I can't get out of my head now.
Falling bodies. He told me some of them were holding hands, leaping from the flaming windows. To these ones, leaping, holding hands, holding their own, I open my arms. Everything it is necessary to understand, they mastered in the last rich moments that they owned. There is no more to learn in life than this, how to love, and how not to miss, to waste the moment, our understanding of this is clear. We are each other's own, near and far, far and wide. Even if we leap into loving in such haste, it is certain there will remain nothing of us left. Consider, the pilot and the hijacker might have been holding hands. Those who wish to make a war of this will never believe it possible. But how enlightenment comes to others, we may never know, or even how someday it may come to us. And if it does not come in this lifetime, we may be hopeful for the next. When he tells me this story, I look deep into my beloved's ear. It is a finely curved, surprisingly small, fleshy on the lower outside, miracle. On the inside, hairy, growing its own wax. It can hear. A love of bodies sweeps over me, and of soul.
It's a lovely thing.
Yes, well, it was very powerful, and I thought the people who, you know, in their final moments looked at each other and said, okay, we're way up here, there's no way of getting out of this building, you know, give me your hand and let's go, let's fly. I have a special feeling for them, and I thought of it as, you know, opening my own arms as they flew to the earth.
Instead of reacting that way, many people reacted with grief, but also with anger. And you might say, I suppose, that that's part of the reason why the country is at war in Iraq at the moment. It makes it a difficult time for a poet, doesn't it?
This is the time for which we're born, exactly the time. So it feels good to be a poet now, because this kind of grief, this kind of sadness, this kind of not knowing, you know, what to do and feeling very unsure about the direction that, you know, the whole world is going. This is the time when the poet is useful, because we are guided by an internal, I don't know what you call it, just internal spirit that seems to be called forth when we are needed, when the world needs this way of seeing life. That's why Audre Lorde used to say that poetry is not a luxury. Poetry is as necessary as bread.
There's a poem I would like to hear you read, if you're willing. It's on page 58.
You mean the one about, I was so puzzled?
Yes.
By the attacks?
Yeah.
Okay. I was so puzzled by the attacks. It was as if they believed we were in a race to succeed, and someone other than death was at the finish line.
You once said about your novel, The Temple of My Familiar, that you couldn't have written it with straightened hair. And of the new poems, you say they couldn't have been written in a bright, sunny room without shadows.
Yeah. In America, there has been this kind of cheerful, you know, perky American brightness and the love of just the light part and not the love of the dark part, which has meant that we are very out of balance. So in Mexico, when I was writing this book, my bedroom there is a big white room and it looks out toward the Pacific. And I discovered that I couldn't really write there because it was too perky and too cheerful and too bright. And so I moved into a really little room, a very dark room, because I wanted to feel the shadows that we as a country really are having to negotiate.
There is another poem in this collection, The Same as Gold, which also seems to be about the places of shadow.
Yes, The Same as Gold. I think for me this was a very important teaching, and it transformed the way that I think of grief. The Same as Gold. Now that I understand that grief, emotionally speaking, is the same as gold, I do not despair that we are all of us born to grieve. There was a small dark girl in my dream the other night. She had been left with me by strange women on their way somewhere else. Taking her into my arms, into my house, which had no roof, my tears covered us like rain.
Alice Walker, reading from her poetry collection entitled Absolute Trust in the Goodness of the Earth. Who's your favorite writer? What's your favorite book? Send us an email at ttbook.org. We'd love to hear from you. Later this hour, the winner of the 2006 Nobel Prize for Literature, Turkey's Orhan Pamuk. And coming up, the controversial writer V.S. Naipaul on Islamic fundamentalism.
I cannot enter the mind of those people. I cannot enter the nihilistic attitude to the world. And the terrible thing is that the people who wish to destroy the world have nothing to put in its place.
I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Writing the World. It's part of the special series, Author, Author, Great Writers on Great Books, presented by, to the best of our knowledge, and PRI, Public Radio International.
Willie was living in the college as in a daze. The learning he was being given was like the food he was eating, without savor. The two were inseparable in his mind.
Novelist V.S. Naipaul.
And just as he ate without pleasure, so with a kind of blindness, he did what the lecturers and tutors asked of him, read the books and articles and did the essays. He was unanchored, with no idea of what lay ahead. At the college, he had to relearn everything that he knew. He had to learn how to eat in public. He had to learn how to greet people and how, having greeted them, not to greet them all over again in a public place 10 or 15 minutes later. Gradually, learning the quaint rules of his college, with the churchy Victorian buildings pretending to be older than they were, Willie began to see in a new way the rules he'd left behind at home. He began to see, and it was upsetting at first, that the old rules were themselves a kind of make-believe, self-imposed. And one day, towards the end of his second term, he saw with great clarity that the old rules no longer bound him.
That's V.S. Naipaul reading from his novel called Half a Life. Many writers and critics were startled when V.S. Naipaul won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2001. Not that anyone questioned his talent. He's been called the greatest living writer in the English language. But Naipaul was a controversial choice. He's famous for speaking his mind no matter who might be offended. And you'll find withering portraits of both the developing world and of Islam in his books. "I am the sum of my books," Naipaul declared when he won the Nobel Prize. Steve Paulson caught up with this controversial literary legend.
You have often been described as a post-colonial writer because many of your books deal with what happens to a country once the imperial power has packed up and gone, once the empire has collapsed.
Yes, yes.
Do you see
yes.
yourself as a post-colonial writer?
Well, what I think I do, I would say I wrote about what happened after the dissolution of empires. So, probably it means the same thing, but post-colonial has a kind of academic, jargony ring which I resist. Probably it's not right of me to do so, but there we are. It's done.
Does it bother you at all that your critics often consider you too harsh when you write about third world countries?
I think they're talking nonsense and rubbish. I pay no attention to them. Because they seldom can tell me where I went wrong. If you're writing about emerging societies, you have to write about people who are losing their way, often losing their way. You have to. And the thing is that the heroes of these societies change with years. I would have looked an awful fool if in 1960 I had taken various colonial leaders as ideals. It would have been, my work would have been not read. We wouldn't be talking about it now.
Because I think the argument on the other side is that you don't come down hard enough on the old colonial powers, and I suppose
foolish thing to say. It's a foolish thing to say, because the world knows about empires, and there's a whole body of thing about imperialism, and I don't wish to join the chorus.
You've also traveled throughout the Islamic world, and you've written about Islamic fundamentalists. Were you completely surprised by what happened on September 11th?
I was astonished, and I cannot enter the mind of those people. I cannot enter the nihilistic attitude to the world of those people. Of course, I know that the nihilism exists. I can see that this fundamentalism leads to that nihilistic attitude, this hatred of humanity, this hatred of the world. And the terrible thing is that the people who wish to destroy the world have nothing to put in its place. This is what I mean by nihilism.
Although if you listen to the rhetoric of someone like Osama bin Laden, it would seem that he would be happy if Americans got out of Saudi Arabia if there was no Western influence in Islamic countries. But you're saying that's not something that you can really argue for.
Well, they want it both ways, don't they? They want freedom to come to your country. They don't want you to go to theirs. I can't understand this kind of exclusivity. If they wish to be alone, they should definitely be alone, and probably because of this religious war that's been declared, the time is coming when we might have to understand that it's not an act of terrorism that took place, but it was a religious war, and that these ideas that the Islamic people need to be alone without other people coming into their lands can be extended in this way, that the Islamic peoples should stay in their own lands, that they should, as it were, be subjected to a kind of quarantine. I think we are going to get there very soon.
So you would say the fundamentalism in Islam is fundamentally different than the kind of fundamentalism we might see among Jews or Christians, that there's a more strident tone to Islamic fundamentalists.
You know, I have to be careful because I don't know. I haven't studied the Jews. I haven't studied Judaism. And Christian fundamentalism here is such a special growth and so, as it were, unrelated to the history of Christianity. Christianity in its beginnings, extraordinary, mysterious faith, very hard to fathom. So the fundamentalism, as people call it, of Christians here, where they exist, is quite different from the call in an Islamic country for people to revert to the origins, to go back to the beginning. No one here can make that call because no one here truly understands or appreciates early Christianity. There is a difference. Fundamentalism here, I suppose, just means following the Bible literally and doing certain things. But the other thing to remember about that, it is set within a set of laws, a constitution, places of learning. It has all kinds of institutions around it, whereas Islamic fundamentalism wouldn't have these institutions. And when they try to set them up, it depends on the will or the fancy of the ruler, and it leads to tyrannies like the Taliban.
V.S. Naipaul won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2001. He's the author of numerous works of fiction and nonfiction, including the celebrated novel A Bend in the River. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Orhan Pamuk won the 2006 Nobel Prize for Literature. Pamuk lives and works in the house he grew up in, a house in Istanbul, on the waterway that divides Europe and Asia. Istanbul has been the center of both Islam and Christianity. Today, Turkey is a secular state, at least on paper. Turks are culturally and historically Muslim. They live in a predominantly Muslim region, and fundamentalist Muslims are at odds with the secular state. In the midst of all this, Orhan Pamuk writes. That's why Steve Paulson asked Pamuk if he believes in God or not.
That's a question they always ask you in Turkey. They ask you, do you believe in God? Are you an atheist? Are you a pure Turk? That kind of questions I've been exposed to. So I know how to deal with these things.
So you said that you've been asked that question many times. Are you an atheist?
Yes, sure.
What do you answer?
Well, you don't directly answer, in fact. Then, of course, you realize that if they ask you that in live TV, you're courage, your outspokenness, how brave or honest you are is also at stake. And also, I think it is a dishonest question, because once you say, well, you know, I don't believe in God too much, someone can shoot you in the street. So you have to do a sort of a slalom, like sort of a dance with music, not to hurt the sensibilities too much if you want to survive, and then also respect your integrity and tell the truth.
Well, and that's really the dynamic that plays out in your novel. I mean, your novel pits these Islamic fundamentalists against the secular authorities, and frankly, neither side comes off looking very good. The Islamicists seem too doctrinaire. They seem intolerant, and then the government and the police are too ready to crack down on people who disagree with them.
I consider myself a pro-Occidentalist, Westernization, and secular, but then not all the people who are secular are good in Turkey. There are the seculars who think that democracy is too much for Turkey, that the army should take care of everything and kill and bomb and just extinguish the political Islamists or even the conservatives. And this is not a good way of preserving a democracy.
But you're wading into some really difficult stuff. I mean, you're talking about political Islam. You're talking about the corruption of government officials. I'm wondering if did you have any trouble getting this book published in Turkey?
We had trouble before publishing the book. My publisher, my friends were a bit worried the book might have confiscated. When you're publishing something outspoken in Turkey, it used to be not now, in the last 2 years, so many things have changed in Turkey. But it used to be that there were two dangers. The danger from government, they may ban your book, and they may send you prison, unlikely for me. It was death. The horrific danger is that someone shoots you in the street, 90% political Islamist, is the gravest danger. And you cannot do anything to avoid it. So we focused on the book's banning. We had lawyers check the book and things like that. But nothing happened, in fact. Then I think, and I agree with some of my friends who say that, my national reputation protected me a bit.
Mm-hmm. So because you, I mean, you are famous. You are the most famous writer in Turkey. But for someone who does not have your celebrity, that person might be more at risk.
Of course, not only this book. Sometimes I write articles. If any of them were written by someone, say, a Kurd in eastern Turkey, that person would be in trouble, would be in jail, would be tortured. All sorts of horror would be coming to him.
Now, I have to say, in Europe and America, you are celebrated. You've become a big name and a big international writer, and you seem to embody the best about Turkey. Again, I'm saying through Western eyes. You seem very modern, more at home in secular culture, and yet very familiar with Islamic culture. But I'm wondering if that's what gets you in trouble, in some circles at least, back in Turkey, that you're seen as too Western.
What do you mean by trouble?
Well, you get a lot of criticism.
Yeah, of course. This is the irony of my life, that I always joke about this, that in Turkey I am a Western, almost a Western spy. Not only look at things from their point of view, but write about them from the Europeans' point of view, that I have been criticized for not being enough of a Turk. But when I'm out of Turkey, I am only a Turk. I'm only a Turk when I get out of my country. Then they constantly refer to me as the Turkish writer. Instead of using my name, they said, and this Turkish writer wrote this, this Turkish writer wrote that. So I'm always confused about this. But I know how to survive with this with a smile.
Orhan Pamuk won the 2006 Nobel Prize for Literature. Steve Paulson spoke with him. And here's a reading from Orhan Pamuk's novel called Snow, a book Pamuk describes as my first and last political novel.
I've always wanted this country to prosper, to modernize, Ka said. But it seemed to me that our religion was always against this. I grew up in Istanbul, among society people. I wanted to be like the Europeans. I couldn't see how I could reconcile my becoming European with a god who required women to wrap themselves in scarves, so I kept religion out of my life. But when I went to Europe, I realized there could be an Allah who was different from the Allah of the bearded provincial reactionaries. Do they have a different god in Europe? Asked the Sheikh jokingly. But now I want to believe in that god who is making this beautiful snow fall from the sky, said Ka. There's a God who pays careful attention to the world's hidden symmetry, a God who will make us all more civilized and refined. Of course there is, my son, said the Sheikh. But that God is not among you. He's outside in the empty night, in the darkness, in the snow that falls inside the hearts of outcasts. If you want to find God by yourself, go ahead, said the Sheikh. Walk out into the darkness, revel in the snow, use it to fill yourself with God's love. But don't forget that arrogant men who think too much of themselves always end up alone. God doesn't have any time for pride. Pride was what got Satan expelled from heaven.
Who's your favorite writer? What's your favorite book? Send us an email at ttbook.org. We'd love to hear from you. Later this hour, novelist Amy Tan on the opposite of fate, and a conversation with Toni Morrison on the unintended consequences of civil rights in America.
One of the cries of the civil rights movement toward its latter part was black nationalism, which meant a kind of separatism. Support our own businesses, our own neighborhoods, et cetera, which was precisely what the situation was prior to civil rights.
I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Writing the World. It's part of the special series Author, Author, Great Writers on Great Books, presented by To the Best of Our Knowledge and PRI, Public Radio International.
Won't you spare me over till another year?
Amy Tan is the author of such novels as Saving Fish from Drowning and The Joy Luck Club. She's also written a memoir called The Opposite of Fate, Memories of a Writing Life. In that book, Tan writes about the murder that shaped her life as a writer and the role that fate has played in her family's history, as she told on Strange Champs.
My mother believed from the time I was about 4 years old that I had the ability to talk to ghosts, and that really was
why did she think that?
Well, it was my fault because I had told her when I was 4 years old that I couldn't go to the bathroom to brush my teeth as she had requested me to because, and I made up this lie that there was a ghost in there, and she said a ghost, you know, and I think a lot of traditional American mothers would have said, you know, let's go in the bathroom and let's go see and then convince the child there was nothing to be scared of in there. My mother took my hand and she took me to the bathroom and she turned on the light and she said in this wondrous voice, where are they? And she was so hopeful that we would actually see the ghost. She was always hoping she would see the ghost of her mother in particular. And I think at times she almost thought that I was her mother reincarnated because maybe I would say something or I had a food preference and she would remember that that was very much like her mother.
Well, after a while, didn't she also come to believe that the ghost of her mother inhabited your computer?
Well, when I wrote my stories, my very first one, The Joy Luck Club, I had something taped to my computer, and it was really to remind me that I should think of the forces of the muse, and it said, call your guardian angel. And my mother used to take that literally, that what I would do is summon up these ghosts who would then help me write. And she walked up to the computer one day, and she said very coyly and kind of in a very shy little girl voice, she said, hello, are you there? Do you miss me? And she thought she was talking to her mother.
It's funny because you've had an unusual number of uncanny experiences in your life. I mean, more than many people have. And some of them have shaped you in very lasting ways. When I'm thinking about the essay in which you trace your decision to become a writer to the really traumatic death of a roommate and the things that, the unexplainable things that happened after his death.
Right. that was probably one of the most life-changing experiences. We're all shaped by people who've died. But that one was a strange one in that he had told me a fear he had, a dream he had the week before, that two men came and strangled him. And he didn't know who they were, and that it was painful, but then it was over and he was fine. He would be fine. And if anything happened to him, could I take care of his possessions and explain things to his parents? And I said, God, you're so morbid. What, you know, I don't know what's going on. Well, he moved out. He was scheduled to move into an apartment closer to school. And we came and stayed that first night. And the next night, two men broke into his apartment and they tied him up and they tortured him and he strangled to death. It was horrendous. And we didn't understand this. I also imagined the names of the people who had killed him, and Ronald and John, and that turned out to be exactly the names of the people who were later arrested and convicted. And I began to have a number of dreams that, whether or not they were just the desire for me to make sense of what had happened, they became the dreams that changed me.
To go back to your title, The Opposite of Fate, I was thinking that the opposite is chance. I mean, fate implies that there's some hidden director shaping your life, and chance suggests that it's all random, and the only direction in life comes from just how we use our own free will to respond to the randomness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is that what you meant, or do you now have another idea about what the opposite of fate would be?
I think the opposite of fate is what I learned my mother had all along, which was not just to believe in fate, but its opposite, which is hope. And in hope, all things are possible. It is not to say that hope is this form of passivity where you're just sitting in a corner crying and saying, I don't know what's going to happen, but I just hope it works out. Hope is the most powerful thing there is. It's the adrenaline of the soul. You can do anything at that moment if you hope enough. You will find the cure. You will find a way to undo it. It's not that you can, you know, change everything completely, but it is such a force of your will, of your determination. And it almost, not that it doesn't matter completely what happens, but that is the opposite of fate, to try and undo that fate, to not just sit there and say, this is the way the world is.
Amy Tan is the author of the novels Saving Fish from Drowning and The Joy Luck Club. She spoke with Anne Strainchamps about her memoir, The Opposite of Fate, Memories of a Writing Life. Toni Morrison is one of our nation's greatest writers. Her novels Sula and Beloved and Song of Solomon are cemented into the American literary canon. Toni Morrison won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1993. Here's Morrison reading from her latest novel called Love.
Once, perhaps twice a year, they punched, grabbed hair, wrestled, bit, slapped, never drawing blood, never apologizing. Finally, they stopped, moved into acid silence, and invented other ways to underscore bitterness. When they searched for more interesting means of causing pain, they had to rely on personal information, things they remembered from childhood. Each thought she was in charge, Christine because she was strappingly healthy. He, however, knew she was still in charge, still winning, not only because she had the money, but because she was what everybody but Papa assumed she was not. Smart.
That's Toni Morrison reading from her novel Love. Morrison says she wanted to write about how relationships in black neighborhoods have changed over the last half century. She told Steve Paulson that the civil rights movement had an unintended consequence. It actually magnified black class differences.
It created them. Created them because now you don't have to live in those neighborhoods anymore. You don't have to go to those black-owned businesses. You don't have to go to the black lawyers, the black doctors. You don't have to go to those powerful, excellent black schools and go anywhere. So those institutions that were dependent in an apartheid situation on the black clientele or patients or students or what have you, many of them failed.
And it was interesting to me that one of the cries of the civil rights movement toward its latter part was black nationalism, which meant a kind of separatism. Support our own businesses, our own neighborhoods, et cetera, which was precisely what the situation was prior to civil rights. All I'm saying is the progress of acquiring full citizenship has a cost.
I'm curious about your background and the role that it plays in your work. You grew up in Lorain, Ohio. I suppose you would call that the heartland of America.
We used to. I think the heart moved in the last few decades.
How much did that particular place shape your writing?
Oh, a lot, I'm sure. It was a small town. It was working class town. One library, one high school, etc. A very, very mixed town. I never really knew, still don't, what it really means to live in an all-black neighborhood. We were just all poor. And I never went to the black schools. I never, you know, participated in that particular kind of experience that seems to be, at least in the public mind, typical of African-American existence. It wasn't for me. And also the incidents of racism to me as a kid or as a teenager were irrelevant. I just thought, you know, this has nothing to do with me. And I'm not going to spend a lot of energy on it. It was not the all-consuming thing for me. But what was consuming were the relationships among us and how history or the society formed us.
Do you think you had different kinds of relationships growing up in that particular environment? I mean, relatively integrated but poor?
Yeah, I think so. I was stunned to see, for instance, the whole press toward busing. It had some logic, but it seemed a little ridiculous to me on the face of it. Switching schools. You know, I've been sitting in schools with white kids all my life. Some were brilliant, some were thugs. Nothing improved because of that. Nothing academic, I mean. But what you get if you grow up that way with other races, Mexicans were there, and East Europeans were there, and tons of Italians, and what we call Czechoslovakians. All those people were there, and you live with them in that town, on that street. They were right next door. So I didn't have any awe, racial awe. You know, you just get rid of it at an early age. Then later on, when you're an adult, you find out, oh, there's something else going on here. So that moving to Washington and seeing signs in the buses that said colored only. For me, now I don't want to make this too glib, but it was kind of a hoot. I would steal those signs. It's kind of little things. We would take them home and put them on the bookcase. Now, mind you, for my parents, there was nothing funny about it at all because they were born in the turn of the century South, Alabama and Georgia. And their whole lives were trying to protect themselves from evil or marauding or violent white people. Theirs was different.
The New Yorker recently did a profile of you, and one of the questions it posed was whether the label black woman writer is limiting. What do you make of that label?
Oh, it's so boring. Oh, God. There is no parallel for this in the history of literature. You know, male French writer, is that limiting? No, I don't think it is, but I understood instantly that it was meant to be, that it was, you know, like woman writer, I suppose, or regional writer or what have you. And so I, instead of pretending that the label had no force, I decided very early on that I would not just accept it, but wear it, force people to say black woman writer, and then to see what the fallout would be. I don't want to be an honorary white man. I mean, it's hopeless. But that doesn't narrow the field. Not for me. It's an interesting, rich terrain in which to work. If I try to compare it with something that is probably more powerful in terms of culture, it would be like saying black music. And what does that mean? Does that sound narrow? This is music that's all over the world. It is the distinguishing feature of American music.
Before you started publishing novels, you worked as an editor at Random House, and you continued to work there earlier in your writing career. Did that experience of working as an editor help you as a writer?
It helped me to know about the business of being a writer. That helps a lot. You know, it quickly disabuses you of any romantic notions you have about publishing a book and what's possible and what probably isn't. But it didn't influence the way I wrote. As a matter of fact, there were times when the balance was not always easy to keep in terms of time. So I would have to cut all whole parts of the year off and not write so that I could do justice to the books I was editing.
So at a certain point, it must have felt very liberating to feel like you didn't have to keep that job anymore. You could just be a writer.
It was enormously liberating. You know what I mean? It was just like, what? You mean I can actually not have a job?
Anyone who wins the Nobel Prize is anointed with special stature, and you are no exception. I read one review of your book, Love, which started out by saying, novelist is too fragile a title for Toni Morrison. She's more like a continent, or at least a landmass, solid, impregnable, a blunt fact. What do you make of comments like that?
I am absolutely repelled, repulsed by that approach to my work. That notion that I, who, you know, I'm a 5'3", 72-year-old woman, and I'm thrilled that I won the Nobel Prize. And whatever goodies come out of that, I accept happily. But to talk about rank in terms of icon and continent is just an embarrassment to me. It's just another way to not talk about the book. It's another way for me to sort of dismiss it. I'm not at all complimented by that. And I am also not beguiled by it.
Toni Morrison won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1993. She's the author of many novels, including Beloved and Tar Baby. Steve Paulson spoke with her. I'm Jim Fleming. You've been listening to Writing the World. Part of the special series Author, Author, Great Writers on Great Books. The series was produced by To the Best of Our Knowledge at the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. For more information on To the Best of Our Knowledge or on this series, go to our website at www.ttbook.org/greatbooks.
PRI, Public Radio International.